there's always at least one person in your life that's like super positive, and no matter how horrible life is going, they always tell you to hang in there, right? Or they always tell you to just think positively and it's all going to be better. You know, it's going to be okay. And I'll be honest, I'm not that person. I often don't feel that way. And I often roll my eyes at the people who are like, it's okay, just push through. And I'm like, you have no idea what my life is like. How dare you give me this poster? But we all need those people in our lives, right? You need that person. My mother is that person for me. And I'm sure if she was here, she would tell you about the many times where I've been like, you don't understand my life, Mom. Don't tell me to just be positive. You don't understand. But it's been so nice to have her remind me that God is in control. When I don't feel in control at all, he's right there. And when you're in the mud of things, in the thick of it, it's really hard to imagine how God could ever take your mess and make it good, right? It's so hard to imagine that, how he could take you from the bottom and bring you back up, how he could get you to hang in there and to keep pushing through. So as I was saying, we're doing Genesis, we're finishing this up, and I'm getting the second part here of Joseph. So Bert started us off in the story. Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery. Talk about messy family stuff, right? That doesn't happen very often. I bet you Joseph didn't want this poster. I bet you if someone told him just hang in there, it would not have been good for him. So he's sold into slavery. He's put into prison. And then from prison, he goes to being the second most powerful man in Egypt, second only to the Pharaoh. And as Joseph predicted, based on the Pharaoh's dreams, they're coming into a seven-year-long famine. So let me tell you what happens from there. So Joseph's brothers end up in Egypt, the brothers who have put him into slavery, because of the food crisis. So they seek help and hopefully enough help to bring back home to their family. They end up getting an audience with the keeper of the food who, plot twist, ends up being Joseph, their brother, who they sent into slavery. But they don't recognize him. So the obvious next step for Joseph, naturally, is to not reveal himself and to test them instead to see if they have changed. I don't think he tested them to be mean, but he could have taken vengeance on them. I think about that if it was me, I probably would have enslaved them myself just to, give them a little kick for what they did to me, or he could have yelled at them, he could have put them in prison, anything, but he didn't. Instead, he talked to them and he asked a lot of questions. Joseph's behavior in the situation was actually is kind of shrewd. The Hebrew word for shrewdness is omrah, and in that context in this story, it's translated to meaning good judgment or prudence or clever, indicating foresight and skill to make godly work possible in difficult contexts. So Jesus even himself counseled the disciples in Matthew 10:16, and he said to be as shrewd as snakes and as harmless as doves, right? So as in we're justifying, Joseph was suspicious, and that was okay, that he wanted to kind of test his brothers. So his motive was to discern their character. He had every reason not to trust them. I wouldn't have trusted them. And he didn't trust their words, their actions, or their commitment to their family. I'm not saying that I think he did it perfectly. He was kind of mean to them a little bit. He withheld critical information, and he manipulated the situation a little bit. So first, he accuses them of being spies, and they deny it. He imprisons one of the brothers and lets the rest go free to see if they'll actually come back to get their brother. They do. They return. He asks to see their youngest brother, Benjamin, which was at this time his father's most beloved son, and they bring him. And he sneaks a silver cup into their stuff, and they return it so that, he could accuse them of stealing. He threatens to enslave Benjamin, their dad's favorite, and they protest, and they're willing to actually sacrifice themselves. So huge change for them, totally different than what they were like 20 years prior. They had proved that to him, and they no longer had that hatred and hostility and jealousy that they had had when Joseph was there. Maybe they had seen how it had affected their family, selling Joseph's, how it affected their father, I'm sure. And life was probably never the same for them after that day. But the question is this: how can Joseph act with such grace and forgiveness after being treated so badly, right? How does this attitude of complete forgiveness and compassion come out of something so nasty and terrible? I think the answer is found in Joseph's theology. He had heard a clear understanding that what his brothers had done to him was evil and bad and terrible. But though they had meant it for evil, God had made it into something good and had used that situation to show his glory. He had a clear understanding that God was in control. So Joseph couldn't sit on his anger anymore and his bitterness from the past. He had to look forward, right? The most beautiful moment to me is when Joseph finally reveals himself to his family. So his identity comes out when his brothers won't give up their youngest brother, Benjamin. And Joseph just breaks down. He cries so loudly that everyone in the house could hear him. This is like a full-on ugly cry. Like, I don't think we see men do the full-on ugly cry very often, but this was like the kind of cry that Pharaoh could hear it. He is finally reunited with his family. It's been 20 years. He probably just was so relieved to see that they were different people. So Joseph says to his brothers, "Please come closer to me." And they came closer. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve your lives." So here Joseph sees the full circle, the full spectrum, right? He had to go through what he did so that he could end up in Egypt and be able to feed his family. So I'm not saying that all suffering ends up coming into full circle. I'm not even saying that we always are able to see the big picture in the midst of our suffering. I think a lot of injustices have been done, and I think we won't ever really get to see the fruit behind that stuff until we're probably in heaven. But this happens to be a great example of getting to see the full picture, right? When you trust God with your life, you also are trusting that he's seeing more than just this part, right? You're trusting that he's seeing the whole thing, and he has a plan. So I think I'm going to do my video. We can cue up the video. So he sees how to take a bad situation and turn it to his glory. So I have this really cool video to show you of going out from the small picture to the big picture. I think that really gives you a perspective of how little itty-bitty we are in this giant universe. And to think that we serve a God that created that. Like, that's insane. That's so cool and amazing to think that, you know, so when we're struggling and we're like, "God, you know, I can't believe you're letting this happen," or "I can't trust you," he made that. I think we could probably trust him with our lives. He did something so powerful and incredible, and it gives me tingles to think about that, and to think that he cares about me when he has a lot of other things to manage. You know, he really shouldn't be worried about me too much, but he does, and he cares, and he knows me, and he loves me. It's incredible. And Joseph was able to, you know, first he's looking like this and only seeing this picture, and he was able to see his story come full circle to be reunited with his brothers. I read a Genesis commentary while I was prepping for this sermon, and they pulled the whole story together really well, so I'm going to just quote the commentary here. It's the far bigger picture. God had a plan for the world, and in order to fulfill that plan for the world, he had a plan for the nation of Israel. And in order to fulfill the plan for the nation of Israel, he had to have a plan for Joseph. And it all was tied together. The plan for his chosen people included their survival during that seven-year famine. And during that seven-year famine, they had no food in Israel. They brought them, which brought them to Egypt, where there was plenty of food. And when they arrived in Egypt, because of the greatness of Joseph, they were given a land of their own, the best land, called the land of Goshen. And over the next four centuries, that group of people would be transformed from a family into a nation that would witness to the glory of God. It was all part of God's plan to fulfill his covenant promises of a seed and salvation that would extend to the whole earth as he promised Abraham in Genesis 12. God was making all things work together for his good to the accomplishing of his great plan. He intended the trials of this one very unlikely hero would be for good and for his and of his family, and then the good of that nation would come out of his family, and through that nation, the good of the world, right? So when we're in the middle of it, you have to think, there's probably a reason. There's something. There's a bigger picture. There's a bigger plan. It's not just our stuff. It's all connected and intertwined, and God just orchestrates it beautifully. It's perfect, right? And that's what he did with Joseph. So here's an extra big perspective for you guys. Joseph's life and Jesus had some similarities too, to give you some extra big picture. Joseph was dearly loved by his father. Joseph was the shepherd of his father's sheep. Joseph was hated by his brothers, stripped of his clothing, and sold for a price into slavery, and taken to Egypt to be tempted. Falsely accused and bound in chains, condemned with criminals. Yet after he suffered, he was highly exalted. He was 30 years old when his public service began. He wept for his brothers. He forgave them of the wrong that they had done and ultimately ended up saving them from death. What men did to hurt him, God turned it for good. All those things in a wonderful analogy were also true about Jesus. They suffered for a bigger cause and for a bigger reason, right? So how do we forgive? Joseph is a great example, right? But this is a long time ago. Like, how do we do this right now today? How do we allow God to take our bad circumstances and our mess that were intended to destroy us and break us and let him turn them to good? And I'm not talking about simple things like a fender bender. I'm not talking about when someone sits in your favorite seat at church. I am talking about the dark and the messy places in our lives. Abuse, abandonment, criminal stuff, betrayal, addictions. How can that stuff be used to glorify God? I think there's about three things that you could do. One thing is to tell your story. When you tell people about your struggles, it really can be a light for them when you don't even know what other people are going through. I know that we all pretend that our problems and our pain and our sin are so original, right? We're so special with our stuff. But there's probably someone out there that's going through the same thing or has gone through the same thing. And it's so great to sync up with them and to share your story with them. When you get to see someone have empathy for you, and when you get to see that your story affected someone, it does a healing thing for you. I remember being at a conference in Chicago, and it was a conference for college students and to bring their non-Christian friends to this conference, and they're like kind of like a seeker conference thing, and it was people that were asking questions about Jesus but weren't like ready to make a full commitment. And we did a prayer ministry time for them after. And I was praying with this young man, and I felt like God told me to share my struggle of depression with this guy. And I was like, no, that's private and personal. And we're not here for me, Jesus. We're here for this guy. So I said no. And I don't know what your relationship with the Lord is like, but it doesn't work well when you say no, at least for me. It usually something happens where he forces me to just go with it anyway. So I said no. And then the guy says, you know, if you could just really pray for my depression. And I was like, I think I have to tell you this story. And he's like, okay. So I end up going really deep with this guy, and I tell him about being really depressed as a teenager after my grandfather passed away, who was like a second dad to me. I tell him that I used to self-harm. I tell him about my eating disorder. I tell him that I was suicidal. I mean, these are like things I don't share with my best friends that I'm sharing with this complete stranger. And I've never felt more raw and vulnerable and a little icky because I'm like nervous about how he's going to respond to what I'm saying. And all of a sudden, he just bursts into tears. And he has been struggling with almost the exact same things that I had struggled with as a teenager. He found it so refreshing to meet a Christian who was honest, who was open, and who didn't have their life all together. He was so surprised that he didn't think Christians could be unhappy, apparently. And I was like, whoa, testimony. Ask God how many times a day I complain or when I'm sad or when I'm struggling. And he was so thankful to hear that story. And it was healing for me, not to be selfish, but it was healing for me to see him be affected by my story. And it was healing for me to share that stuff and to be vulnerable with him. And we prayed together. We cried together. It was awesome and really, really special. And to see God kind of use my story full circle was really special. To see that maybe I suffered some of that stuff, to share this with this guy. Maybe that changed his life. Maybe that was that moment for him where the light bulb came on and he wanted to give his life to the Lord. I don't know. I don't know what it was for, but I know that I did my part and did what the Lord said, and I get to let God take the wheel and do the rest. Another way that you can allow God to take what was meant to destroy you and make it good is to share the burden. So don't go through it alone. A lot of times when you share a burden and you walk through it with others, you can really see God's glory through the people around you. The advice, the love, and the grace that you get from people when they want to serve you and rally around you when you're in the middle of your mess is a real testament to God's glory and his grace. I like to call this my dark year. During my dark year was when my friend committed suicide. My aunt died of a heart attack and a stroke, and my brother passed away all within a month. It was incredible to have community. I genuinely could not get out of bed. I couldn't put clothes on. I'm not going to cry. See? Linda, this is you. That was all you. That was your fault. I could not get out of bed. I could not move. I could not do anything. I had a 2-year-old daughter who needed her mom, and I couldn't. I just couldn't. And my community jumped in. My husband, part of my community, jumped in and got me dressed many days where I was like, I just want to stop. And he was like, nope, we got to keep going. He did the hang in there cat poster and was like, you pull yourself together, Vinay. And he got me through it and my friends got me through it. And I just think, what if I hadn't shared that? What if I hadn't let people in and I didn't share my burden? I'm pretty sure I'd still be laying in bed not getting dressed. I'm just saying, I wouldn't be here. And I let God infiltrate my life through the power of other people. The third way is the obvious answer, Jesus. We cannot do anything without Jesus. This is obvious. Remembering that he's walking with you in each moment, remembering that he sees the whole picture, right, all of the universe, and then can zoom in on your stuff too, is incredible. Knowing that he sacrificed himself so that you can spend all of eternity, not just like a few years, a few hundred years, but all of eternity with him is incredible. I'm a believer that you can get through anything with Jesus, not without. Get on your knees and pray. Get on your knees and ask him to meet you where you're at, in the mud, when you're at your messiest. That's when you should be calling on Jesus and asking him to meet you where you're at. He provides a healing that no one else can, that no one else is capable of. And having community is helpful, but having the power of Jesus and the Holy Spirit to back you up is a whole other level of healing that you can experience. So I'm going to end with a story, and I'm going fast here, but my story is going to take long. This is one of my favorite stories that I grew up hearing a lot. So I'm going to try to not cry in this story. That's my goal. But if I do, forgive me. So Vandel was 5 years old when his dad took him to his aunt's house. His dad was just going to the store, and he said he would be right back. Vandel was excited because his family was going to move to California. So it's his mom, his dad, and his big sister. It was a new start for them. And his dad never came back from the store. His dad didn't call. He didn't write. He didn't tell anyone where he was going. He just disappeared. As the years passed, Vandel was exposed to a very violent life. He had lived in survival mode. Growing up in the projects of Chicago changed an innocent child into a jaded teen. At 16, Vandel forged his alcoholic mother's signature and took a bus to the Job Corps with only a few dollars in his pocket. From there, he enlisted in the Army, and he was so happy to be in the Army because for the first time in his entire childhood, he had 3 square meals a day, he had clean clothes, and he had a shower, all of these things that he was missing as a child. He became a drill sergeant, and he loved being in the military. He thrived in the military. He made friends that he's had all his life. He met people that were different from him and got to see a big world. He eventually becomes a military police and moves to Germany. He gets to learn to speak German. He gets his own house out there. He loves it. He also went to Okinawa, Japan, and got to see the world during Vietnam. He eventually returns home and to his hometown of Chicago, where he becomes a police detective. God had taken what was meant to destroy him, losing his father, growing up in a violent, abusive home, and God had made it into something good and made a strong man. When he was 36 years old and his new wife was 8 months pregnant with a baby girl who they would later name Vinay, a stranger came to the door. It was Vandel's dad. The man he hadn't seen in 31 years came back and appeared at his doorstep, wanting a relationship with his son. And in that moment, Vandel could have let bitterness overcome him, and he could have blamed his dad for all the hurt and all the pain that he had gone through. And he could have done rightfully so. No one would have judged him for that. But instead, do you know what he did? He hugged his dad. He hugged him, and he just embraced him, and he just absorbed the moment. In that hug, all the years of pain and desperation and loneliness had melted away. The desire to be with his dad was fulfilled. God overwhelmed Vandel with grace for his father. He had his own Joseph moment, right? Everything came full circle. He got to spend another few years with his dad before his dad passed away, and they wasted no time. They immediately planned a road trip, and they went to California, where his dad had been living the whole time. My dad tells the story that he rented a convertible with his dad, and they're like cruising down the street in California, and my dad said they're like talking about like pretty ladies for my grandpa or whatever, and he's like, "Hey, Dad, what about that one?" And he's like, "She's too old for me," or whatever. And they're just enjoying their father-son time. They got to go fishing together. They got to hang out and spend a lot of time together. I got to meet my grandfather. I was a baby, but I got to meet him. God had taken a really terrible, horrible situation that has affected generations in my family and turned it into something good. He took something that the enemy had intended for harm and turned it into a beautiful story of a father and son reuniting. A And my dad is the best dad. For a man that did not have a dad, I have a really awesome dad. And he not one time has ever spoken poorly about his dad. Not one time has my dad shown any sign of bitterness or anger about his situation. Not one time has my dad ever talked about his childhood with anything more than like, really, my dad has a great sense of humor. So when he tells stories of stealing cars, he always made them sound really funny and fun for me. Not the criminal part of it. I'm like, ooh, you stole a car. And he always made my Nana sound like an angel, even though she was an alcoholic and was absent. And my dad has done such a good job at letting God into his life and letting God take that situation and run with it and show his glory and his grace and his goodness through that story. So I want us to start to trust God's seeing the full picture. I want us to trust that God can take old, tattered, and beat up and messed up things, and he can make them new. I want us to really believe that in our mess and in our junk, God can make something beautiful out of it. I want us as a congregation to show that to the world, that the God that we serve has taken all of us who have come from such small things, and God can make such big things out of us, right? And I want us to reflect that to Fort Collins. I want us to reflect that to Colorado, and I want us to do it for the world, really. I think that there is something so special when people can see followers of Christ really trusting God, followers of Christ being messy too, but letting God do good things with our mess, right? We all have a story. We all have junk. We all have mess. I've heard some of your stories, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that you're here. I can't believe that you're handling that so well with such grace. And all of you that I've heard your story have always told me it was God. It was God. I couldn't dwell on it. I had to let God take it. So I really challenge us today, church, that we can do that, that we can just start letting God put together the pieces for our puzzle, and that we can allow him to show us that bigger picture, right? So I just want to pray, and then we can continue in worship. God, thank you so much for being in control, for seeing the parts of our story that we cannot see. Lord, for you seeing the beginning and the end, not just the middle, which is what we see, Lord. And I just ask right now, God, that if any of us are going through a hard time or we're in the midst of the mud, Lord, that you help us see that you have a plan, that you're not going to just leave us in the mud, Lord, but you're going to take us out of it, and you're going to use our story to bring others to you. You're going to use our story for your glory, Lord. I ask, Lord, that today and every day, God, that you help us to see the little ways and the big ways that you're in control, that you help us not to always dwell on the negative, Lord, but you help us to see the positive, that you help us to see the positive part is that you are in our lives, Lord. And for those of us who don't have you in our lives, I pray for them as well, Lord. I pray that you help us to crave you, to desire you, to want us to have you in our lives, to have you be in control, to have you make our mess into something beautiful. Thank you, God, for who you are and what you've done and what you will do. In Jesus' name, amen.